Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Aaron Brooks Show. And today we've got a special guest, and this is part of a series of interviews that I'm going to be doing in the next few months, few years, who knows. Basically interviewing objectivist intellectuals in all kinds of fields. So we did Greg Salimieri recently. We did Ilan Juno recently, and today we're going to be interviewing an objectivist psychologist. I don't know. She'll tell me if I can say that or not. But an objectivist psychologist, Gina Golan. And let me put Gina on screen. There we go. Hi, Gina. How's it going?
Hi.
All right, so I've known Gina, it's a little embarrassing, but since she was in high school, a long, long time, well, not that long, she's still young, and Gina actually won the Fountainhead Essay Contest twice in a row.
Are we still doing this?
Yeah, we're still doing that. We're still doing it. You're still getting credit for all the stuff you did when you were young, and then you're going to have to prove that you're up to it now that you're now that you're older. So I met Gina way back then, I think, and then Gina was part of the ARI's programs, part of the OEC. I spoke, I think, for a campus club that Gina had at Tufts, twice at Tufts. And since then, she's gone on to get a PhD in clinical psychology at Virginia. She's a postdoc at Boston University in clinical psychology, and she just got a job. Exciting. So she'll be moving to New York, where she's going to be. You're going to what? Professor of what?
Of clinical psychology.
Of clinical psychology at Yeshiva University in the graduate program at Yeshiva University. So, congratulations on everything you've achieved so far.
Thank you for all the ways that you've made it possible.
My pleasure. So speak up a little bit, Gina, and We're gonna talk psychology now. Not a field I know anything about, so it hasn't prevented me from talking about it, right?
So, as usual. Okay.
It's a field that I'm intrigued by, curious by, for the obvious reasons that I think everybody who thinks wants to know something about psychology, but also because lately I've been having to deal with Jordan Peterson, so, not personally, but theoretically, so had to kind of deal with these with psychological issues or issues in psychology, which are interesting. So let's start really with something you told me, with kind of the field that you're working on right now, which is the relationship of psychology to philosophy. So is there a relationship? What is the relationship? Why?
All the big questions.
Start with big and we'll narrow it down.
Well, first, I should just say, you know, when you say it's the field I'm working on, there's no field, right? So I'm at the intersection of several fields, which is part of the challenge and part of the fun. And I think it's important and needs to happen. But the question of how are they related, you know, what is the precise relationship and how should they inform each other is largely unanswered, as far as I know, you know, to the best of my knowledge. And so that's largely what I'm working on, is actually conceptualizing and operationalizing the relationship. And I'm really starting to venture in that direction in my academic work only now that I am a little bit established, in the sense that I have a job and I'm going to have my own independent, you know, faculty position and won't be working under someone's auspices. And so I've really just been making inroads in terms of having a little foundation grant through the Templeton Foundation, which encourages this type of interdisciplinary research, and working with some faculty that I had begun collaborating with in graduate school who are also interested in trying to forge those relationships, but from a different angle. So I would say so far, I have hypotheses about how it is and ought to be related.
Okay.
And those in themselves are controversial within the field, at least. So, you know, for example, the hypothesis that we need to identify and take positions on our patients' moral and philosophical values in order to best treat them, in order to actually provide the best care and help them make their own best choices in terms of they're a mental health. So that's a really controversial claim.
It must be hugely controversial. I mean, to make those kind of value judgments is just unthinkable in any field, including moral philosophy, I think, never mind in psychology. But the idea that there's some values that are good for you in some way and other values that are not, and that somebody external can tell you that is quite controversial.
And I think it's rightly controversial in a sense, because there's a very appropriate skepticism and cautiousness about what passes for moral values these days.
Yes.
And interestingly, I've actually had some conversations both with philosophers and clinical psychologists across a couple talks I've given recently that addresses this issue. In one case, a philosopher told me, no, when you say moral, you're talking about Kantian, like deontological, you know, imperative. Like, you don't, that can't be what you think is good for your patients. And I said, no, you're right. I think that's terrible for my patients. However, I do think they need some sort of moral framework and moral guidance. And there's no getting around that. And I think that's partly why it's so important for us to talk about it and, you know, reclaim the term morality from the Kantian tradition. So
And I can imagine the subjectivists would, you know, anybody who is a subjectivist would argue with you and, you know, so yes, I can't imagine who in philosophy today, other than I guess objectivists, would think that there were appropriate values for mental health.
Well, so in fairness to modern philosophy, so there is this. I've recently been learning as I start delving into the philosophical literature that will inform this for me. There's a resurgence of kind of virtue ethical theories from Philippa Foote. Maybe Anscombe was even before Foote, and sort of onward through some more modern proponents of virtue ethics. Virtue epistemology is burgeoning.
And virtue ethics is the idea that that there are some virtues that are appropriate for human life. Is that the standard?
Yeah, exactly. That you can derive from a careful study of human nature and what is the human good, given the psychological needs of the particular type of organism
would you think of the objectivist moral philosophy as a subset within virtue ethics?
So this is where I have to issue the disclaimer that I'm not a philosopher.
Yes, you're not a philosopher. Well, neither am I, so it's cool.
but I do at least know that that's often where, you know, non-objectivists who are trying to take Ayn Rand seriously and grapple with her views and where they fit within the broader philosophical canon, I think that's where they naturally will put her. And it makes some sense to me that, you know, there's at least a lot more in common. And obviously, you know, she drew heavily on Aristotle's philosophical insights, including his insights about virtue. I know that there are obviously really important differences, but the differences, I think, build on rather than directly, you know, contradict or in some fundamental way disown his perspective. And so the broad idea that we can derive ethical norms and ethical guidance from a study of human nature, so far I don't think that there's any contradiction, right? And I think that really does fit nicely with then how Rand builds further on the conception of your life as this fundamental alternative.
Good. So if positive values or correct values, put it this way, correct values and virtues necessary for mental health, could we explain a lot of the problems with mental health? And a lot of I think it's a little bit hysteria, but there's a lot of claims about dramatic rise in mental health problems in America today, and whether there is or there isn't, you know, that's an empirical question. But could we explain a lot of those problems by reference to bad values and bad virtues that exist in the culture, or bad philosophy that exists in the culture?
Yeah, so I think it's actually a really complicated question. I think it's very easy to try to oversimplify or to try to import kind of familiar categories, you know, in either direction, just like it would be really crazy for someone working within a mainstream empiricist framework in psychology to consider the notion that, you know, philosophical ideas A, may have a truth status that you can establish, especially normative ideas in philosophy, may be good or bad, right or wrong, and may have a really profound impact on mental health, and especially, and then at a cultural level, that the ideas of a culture can have a profound impact. So I definitely think that ideas are having much more of an impact than my fellow psychologists would say.
Yep.
However, I also think it's really complicated, and I think it's too easy to overinterpret, you know, and to not fully hold the context of all the complicated factors that contribute to a given mental health problem. You know, so
what would be other complicated factors, for example, that contribute?
Sure. So everything from biological vulnerability, which we can't ignore, to early, you know, childhood adversity, trauma, stressors that, especially certain kinds of stressors and interpersonal stressors in particular, you know, psychology has actually contributed a great deal of knowledge about the particular predictors of particular mental health problems. And it's, you know, in some cases uncontroversial that if you were abused as a kid, you're more likely to have certain, obviously, right?
Yeah.
But then there are other predictors that are kind of more diffuse, or that have, if you ruminate, if you engage in certain kinds of mental habits, or even are more prone to those mental habits, that the habit can kind of mediate the relationship between a genetic vulnerability and the development of an actual disorder, suggesting that something about your genetic makeup somehow might have made you more vulnerable to engaging in certain unhelpful thinking processes, which may sound really radical to an objectivist listener, but the evidence sure suggests that that's the case, you know, and then that in turn may make you more vulnerable to certain psychological disorders. So it's really a mix of factors.
So let's go back to that part that's hard for objectivists, because I think it's important. So what you're saying is that your particularly genetic dispositions might, and plus some experiences that you might have, might impact your epistemology in a sense, or your thinking.
Yep.
And
that's my contention.
What's that?
That's my claim.
Yeah. No, I it makes sense. And what would be the remedy for that?
Well, interestingly enough, the remedy largely turns out to be cognitive behavioral therapy, which involves learning new thinking habits and learning new approaches to processing data and even, you know, paying attention in different ways, and medication, you know, can often be helpful, and often the two in concert can offer synergistic benefits. And so it doesn't seem like one size is necessarily going to fit all, even when the etiology or the causal path differs.
So let me get to medication in a minute. A mental note to ask you about that. But so let's talk about the cognitive therapy. How does that work? I don't know much about it. I don't think many of our viewers know much about it. So what is cognitive therapy and how does it work?
Mm-hmm. So in its essence, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is how it's most commonly referred to now, is a set of techniques that is premised on the idea that our emotional responses come from certain ways of thinking. So both come from certain content, like certain beliefs, or what Aaron Beck, who's the main founder of CBT, called automatic thoughts, certain beliefs that then lead us to automatically interpret situations in certain ways, make kind of snap judgments without even necessarily being conscious of it. And that by changing how we think, we can change how we feel over time. That's 50% very loosely speaking, of the approach. And then really the other half of the approach, which has gained in prominence largely, I think, because of all the overwhelming empirical evidence that it's really important and works really well, is the behavior part, which involves actually going out and gathering data, in effect, to change your beliefs over time by actually doing things differently than your emotions tell you.
Okay.
You know, and by actually exposing yourself to the things that you habitually avoid, you know, and
so in a sense, empirically proving to yourself that the new thoughts are right.
Essentially.
Yep.
Yeah. And different cognitive behavioral therapists who are more heavily influenced by the cognitive versus the behavioral tradition may have different explanations of why it works. So the really behavioral, because in some ways, you know, we're familiar with the fact that there was this behaviorist movement in psychology that really took hold for a short but important period of time and then has since largely been dismantled by the cognitive revolution, but not entirely, you know, it's still entrenched in a lot of currents within psychology. And so the cognitive behavioral movement has been this hybrid of the more cognitive revolution kind of side of things. So thinking about mental events and mental representations as being important and measurable, but also by the behaviorist tradition, which really emphasizes the importance of observable action over whatever happens in our head.
Yeah.
And so this hybrid has emerged. And now we have this treatment that partly through a lot of refinement and added nuance through experimentation over the years, I think has actually become very rich and very effective in treating a range of psychological problems, but people will have different accounts of why. You know, so there's a range of kind of conceptual frameworks underlying psychologists' views of what is it about exposure therapy, for example, that works. You know, is it just we're reconditioning you the way we would recondition a rat?
Yeah.
Or is there some sort of internal learning process happening that's also mediated by concepts and values and beliefs that then leads you to change how you feel?
So I assume you would be supportive of the second approach, of the second explanation. So do you have an explanation for how it works and why it works?
Yeah. So, well, the second thing I said much more closely, I think, represents how I would think about it. So I would say, in essence, like, there's a lot of nuance to it, and it definitely can get complicated about all the little causal, the links in the chain. But the fundamental thing we're doing is we're giving people different experiences that then we're also teaching them to think about in more rational, more contextual ways, while really getting a sort of concrete embodied experience that in effect dramatizes for them the new belief. You know, that we're helping people see in action, oh, this fear that I had is misplaced, you know, or this actually, when I do this, it goes better than I thought it would.
All right, so here's a question. So I'm all ideas influenced by psychology. That makes sense to me. And it doesn't explain everything. And we talked about one of the and we'll talk about the other explainers in a minute. So ideas influence our psychology. But there's also an implication from some of what you said that our psychology influences our ideas or can influence our ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I so often am trying to argue the other case. It's obvious to everyone around me, you know, that, well, of course, our psychologies influence everything, but this is a really good exercise for me. One way that I think it's plausible to say that psychology influences our ideas, just from my collected observation, is that some people who are naturally more inhibited, more cautious, have more of a kind of temperamental tendency to feel a lot of anxious reactivity to even a fairly minimal cue, you know, that they interpret as somehow dangerous, threatening, or even ambiguous. So people who kind of have that heightened sensitivity, wherever that comes from, which seems to be at least partially preconceptual, will be more prone, all else being equal, to develop ideas that really emphasize kind of malevolent, threatening kinds of evidence, you know, because they're just much more attuned to that kind of evidence. And that beliefs that also reflect a kind of cautiousness informing belief, you know, so they're more likely to be obedient or agreeable or compliant with the beliefs of their parents or, you know, other people in their environment, partly perhaps out of cautiousness, you know, because it feels like these authority figures have a lot of power over them. And perhaps if they don't toe the line, then it's going to be really, really scary and bad and they'll get in trouble. You know, so this is one hypothesis about how exactly the pathway might work, but observationally, I see that certain you know, people with certain temperamental traits seem to be statistically more prone to kind of wind up with certain beliefs. And then we also know there's a heritable component to certain beliefs. So even when you control for...
Well, not to beliefs, it seems like heritable to the inclinations.
To winding up with a certain ideological position or in a certain ideological camp.
Okay.
So... And
would that be Jonathan Haidt's like work?
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So there's now largely because of Jonathan Haidt's work, there's now a popular strand within empirical psychology, which involves, kind of tracing out the genetic as well as environmental pathways through which somebody winds up being more conservative versus more liberal.
How do we not get into the trap of then making it deterministic, right? So I'm born with these genes, I'm going to be conservative, so what's the point, right? So how do we avoid that?
Yeah, so this actually, you know, we're not alone in that battle because I happen to be working pretty closely with some of the psychologists within behavior genetics, which is the field that studies kind of the genetics of complex human traits, and particularly psychological personality traits, that there's a real pushback happening right now. So Eric Turkheimer, who's one of my former professors and has gotten entrenched in this debate with Sam Harris, who is defending Charles Murray, who wrote The Bell Curve, arguing that we are racially predetermined to be smart or not, right? So Eric, part of the reason he's gotten flack from Sam Harris in defense of Charles Murray is that he has been arguing pretty strongly against the deterministic interpretation of heritability. And he's himself a behavior geneticist, so he knows what he's talking about.
Sure.
You know, and one of the core arguments that he makes is just to point to the methodology by which we sort of estimate heritability percentages, you know, how heritable or how much do genes contribute to such and such behavior. Inherently, for one, we're just looking at a snapshot at a certain, you know, in a certain cultural context, within a certain community or sample, at a certain point in time, how much, statistically speaking, you know, how much of the kind of variability in religiousness or in, you know, criminal behavior or whatever can be kind of correlationally accounted for by genes, by having like a twin with it versus only a monozygotic versus a dizygotic twin, for example, right?
Yep.
And all that tells us is, by default, you know, this much of your that there's kind of some sort of influence happening on your behavior, all else being equal. But that's all else being equal. It doesn't mean you can't change it. And he, in fact, is famous for showing that there are certain interaction effects between how heritable something is and what happens in your environment, such that if you experience certain kinds of opportunities or kind of you have opportunity to disrupt your development in certain ways or to kind of add other ingredients, suddenly some certain traits just won't be as heritable anymore.
Okay.
This goes for intelligence. This goes for, you know, height is actually less heritable in countries with poor nutrition than it is here.
Yep.
Right. So heritability is not, you know, the universal explainer.
Dominant function. So we've got, I mean, this always comes up, right? We've got how much is heritable, and then you've got the environment influencing, and those two are interacting. And it sounds like he's saying that the environment can influence in dramatic fashion. But what about that third element, which is free will, and to what extent choices you make, and to what extent the psychologists out there recognize its importance, and to what extent do you think it is important?
Yeah, so I just came from a conference where this was the theme. It's called Genetics and Human Agency. This particular initiative, Eric Turkheimer, who I mentioned, is the leader of the initiative. And so we spent all weekend arguing this exact set of questions. And two of us were sort of closet objectivists, but certainly none of the rest were. So in terms of what I can say emerged, and this is already somewhat of a skewed sample because these are people interested in these questions. Right. So they're thinking about what does it mean to have agency? How do we preserve
an agency?
Our
by agency, you mean basically free will, right? Because it's an academic term for something like free will.
Yeah. And so what I can say at least of the psychologists who are thinking actively about this issue, is that they really want to preserve some semblance of personal responsibility, choice, agency. They're also all near universally compatibilists. So, that, you know, within the philosophical traditions, of the perspectives one could have on free will, it's very rare for someone who calls himself or herself a scientist, you know, and exists within this scholarly community to admit to being a libertarian, which is within the philosophical tradition, doesn't have anything to do with necessarily the political, you know, party movement. It specifically means that you believe that one could choose more than one way, you know, all else being equal. So you're kind of the opposite of a hard determinist, and then the soft determinist or compatibilist in between are just trying to have it both ways. But given, you know, it's really, really scary and unthinkable to mainstream psychologists to conceive of this type of causality where you really could just make more than one possible thing happen, given everything else being equal up to that moment. You know, it just metaphysically, it just blows their minds and they don't know how to think about it, which is understandable because I think it's actually really hard. I think it took me a year of intensive training with Ankar in the OAC to wrap my head around it. So I'm not blaming but short of that, Eric actually makes a strong argument, the strongest he can, given he's a compatibilist, for the idea that this inability by behavior geneticists to explain everything away. It's like, as hard as they've tried, they just hit this wall 30, 40 years ago where about 50% of the variability in every behavior doesn't seem accountable for either by genes or by shared environment.
Okay.
So it's just relegated to what they call non-shared environment.
Okay.
So it's whatever it is that twins do separately from each other that makes them different rather than similar.
Okay.
So, and he has a commentary he once wrote that then forms the basis of this whole initiative called, it was called Genetics and Human Agency. And the claim he makes there and elsewhere is that that non-shared environment component is, in a phrase, free will, which I think is a muddy way of putting it. He wouldn't even own that claim in a precise way, but what he was sort of roughly trying to get at and has clarified since is the idea that the fact that we can't seem to explain away so much of our behavior and morality and the ways that we develop it makes sense in light of our own internal experience of actually choosing, of actually having autonomy, of the complicated process that we go through when we try to make sense of everything that's happening to us and then make choices about what to do next. And that there isn't any explaining of that. And we shouldn't be explaining that away because it's what makes us human.
So it strikes me that different people are going to be affected differently by this combination of three things, depending on how engaged they are with how frequently they engage their own free will, because free will doesn't automatically happen, right? It's something you have to engage. You have to engage your mind, which is the act of choosing, which is the act of free will. And if you don't do that, or if you don't do that very often, or if you do that kind of in a fuzzy kind of, then the environment and your genes are going to have a much bigger impact on you. And if you do, you have much more control over, you know, the values and virtues and therefore over your psychology in some sense.
Exactly.
So does that make sense?
And that's a hypothesis that I've been testing as part of this project. Is I've been developing a term and a concept that I think is close to but not identical with the objectivist concept of focus, which I could say more about.
Sure. Go ahead.
If it's interesting, but I've been thinking about ways to measure it and ways to, what I've been calling it now, epistemic integrity. So kind of the chosen adherence to reality oriented thinking as active. I've called it being actively honest with oneself. So I can talk about again.
I'm curious how you measure that. How would you test for that?
Still working on it.
Okay.
So I'll get back.
What are your thoughts? Now you've intrigued me.
So I'll let you know, but I have been developing some measures. We'll see how they fare, and they seem to correlate with the things you'd expect them to correlate with so far, but it's all in the early stages of development. And it's hard to measure it through self-report because you're asking people how honest they are.
Yeah.
So you can imagine that's difficult. to get at directly, but we're thinking about different ways of doing it.
And then how, then you would correlate that with, you know, their particular genetic makeup, you would actually go.
Well, that, but also, so there's some evidence I've now cited and presented at conferences like this one, suggesting things that are, that seem to be at least closely related to thinking style, not so much content, but style. Things like there's this component of the personality factor conscientiousness, which is, you know, one of these big five personality traits that psychologists talk about. This subscale called deliberation, so deliberativeness, the tendency to think carefully before making a decision and generally weigh evidence and just be deliberative in your thinking, for lack of a better word. It, interestingly, across a couple different studies, it seems to be less heritable than other aspects of personality and, for example, intelligence.
How do you control for all the factors in order to come to a conclusion like that?
Well, one way you control for them is you enter them in all at once. So they're all automatically kind of control. Statistically, there's sort of a complicated mix of things that you do. But basically, if you are predicting them all simultaneously, they're sort of all in your model.
Yeah, so they're controlling for one another, supposedly, unless there's autocorrelation. I mean, there's a lot of complexity there just in the econometrics of it.
But the idea is that it seems to be there's a high quote non-shared environment variance, which is that component that's not explained by either genes or shared environment. And but what I hypothesized in them sort of in the early stages of testing is what I think the more interesting implication would be, which is if you're higher in this deliberation feature, you know, if you say that you're somebody who thinks carefully through things and you like to actually gather evidence before reaching decisions, then other traits should be less heritable, you know, to the degree that what basically what you just said, right? That, and we empirically we can test that.
Oh, that's cool.
So like your tendency to alcohol, to problematic alcohol use, delinquent behavior, various things that I can look at in the particular data set I'm working in, that they should be less heritable to the degree that even 14 years earlier, because this is a longitudinal study, so we can look at that. You know, as a kid, you reported that you tend to deliberate carefully and be planful in your decision making. So far, you know, I have just the earliest bits of evidence that I can't.
I mean, it's really cool that there are people, and not just you, but there are people, it sounds like, thinking about the role of thinking in these deep issues in psychology. Academically, because when you listen to people out there who talk about psychology, you know, again, Jordan Peterson and many others, even Sam Harris and others, they talk about reason kind of as a floating thing, but they never talk about the relationship between reason and thinking and between really anything, particularly related to you and who you are and the values you choose and your psychology and why you have certain inclinations and why you don't. So it's really cool to see that there are actually people doing that, because it doesn't come across in kind of that more popular representation of psychology.
No, there's a lot happening that is good. And I mean, this is one tiny subset of the broader research community. There's also a lot of work on rational thinking and training of rational thinking that quite a few researchers have been working on for some time. And that's shown that there are individual differences, not just in people's raw intelligence, but in how rationally they think, and that those individual differences predict how well they make decisions, shockingly, and actually predict
And hopefully that you can teach them, right? That you can teach them to think better.
And we're still, the research is sort of young in that, the official research at least, you know, where that's the goal, is to prove that we can actually train people to think better. But there are promising findings, and the researchers in question are excited about that.
Because it's interesting, because there's a whole field now in economics called, you know, that deals with cognitive biases in economics. Mm-hmm. And it's always struck me that cognitive biases, people have cognitive biases. People make mistakes in thinking. And maybe there's even something systemic where we all tend to make certain mistakes because of something. It's hard to tell why. But I always thought, well, the whole point is to fix them, right? The whole point of letting us know that we have cognitive biases is because we can overcome them. And I once spoke to, I don't know if you're Dan Ariely, I think his name is. He's a...
Dan Ariely. Yeah. I cited him heavily.
All right. So I asked Dan Ariely because I met him. And I asked him, so is the purpose of all the things that you're discovering, is it to teach us? And he said, no, people can't change.
That's funny you say that, because in his book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, although I don't think he spends as much time on it as I would if I were him, but he actually... maybe on you know, editors' recommendations, or because someone pointed out.
Well, my view is he is very dishonest. That's my view. But I wouldn't be surprised if he put stuff in there.
He does point to evidence that you can train people, a little bit of it, not nearly as much as they're.
So what he told me is no, and that's why he believes in the whole nudge theory. Is the idea is no, some people can learn, but most people can't. We can't teach them, so we have to nudge them into doing the right thing, because they'll never learn how to do the right thing. But I think, I mean, I haven't read that book, but I read a previous one of his books. I don't know. I found him very shallow and uninteresting. So, I mean, you're citing him, so there must be something there, or maybe he's just very prominent. But
There is a mix of both. So the wider context that we need to put him in, so he's a... I would say primarily social psychologist, at least in his methods. I don't know if that's what he would call himself. And within social psychology, more than any other branch of psychology, there is a pretty firmly rooted skepticism about both the human capacity for, or even the benefits of thinking honestly.
Yep.
And being honest about our motivations. So there's so I've fought the social psychologist harder than anybody else. And it's interesting when I speak to like personality psychologists or behavior geneticists or clinical psychologists, and I tell them, I'm saying something really radical here, guys. I'm going to claim that we're both capable of thinking honestly and that we should do it. And they look at me like, well, I mean, you know, there are particular questions they have, but what, I mean, that we can, that seems, you know, there are philosophers who've been saying that. But when I talk to a room of social psychologists, like, I lose them.
You lose them. They can't even think.
Like, what? What do you mean that we can't? But look at all our research showing not only that we can't, but more importantly, that we shouldn't, because it seems good for us to deceive ourselves a little bit. So that's a literature I've been up against.
Well, I don't know. I mean, again, because I've encountered him in economics and finance. So he has this whole thing about people are not motivated. Bonuses don't help, right? So giving managers bonuses don't result in anything. And he says, I can't test it. Because I can't actually go into the field and give people enough money to actually change their behavior, because it would require a lot of money and I don't have the resources. So what he did is he went to India. And he went into a very poor village in India, and he set up in a room a bunch of, different puzzles and things that tested your abilities. And he had people come in and do them, and, you know, in a sense, recorded the results. And then he said, okay, if you do it, I'm going to give you I'm going to give you 2 days worth of income, or a month worth of income. In India, it's very little money. If you do it this much better. And he said the results were, they did it worse. They didn't do it better. And his conclusion from that is, listen, I mean, this is what blows me away, right? From this conclusion in a village in India, he concludes that giving managers, particularly CEOs, bonuses actually reduces their performance.
Yeah, because, I mean, look, much evidence to the contrary that it's laughable.
But it's also laughable to take a sample of villagers doing a task that is the first time they've ever done it, and where you're giving them a lot of money, and money is yes, it's nerve-wracking, and they're nervous, so they underperform, versus a CEO who's been groomed, who's been doing the same functions for 30 years, who's trained, and now you're giving him more money to do it better. It's so dishonest in my mind to present those two as comparable in any way that I lost all respect for him. And then I met him, and I found him to be very, again, dishonest.
What's really important about so what I find useful about a lot of his research is just descriptively, he's very clever, I would say, in terms of setting up experimental designs that allow you to indirectly measure somebody's cheating behavior, for example, without having to ask them, hey, so how often do you cheat? You know, which presents challenges to them. So he's run a lot of these different studies that show kind of specific manipulations that you can do, you know, in the nudge kind of vein that lead people to be more or less dishonest. And then his interpretations, and to some extent, even the way he designed the studies, fundamentally rest on a view of morality and a view of like what honesty is and why on earth one ought to do it. That's ultimately Kantian, you know, that there's this set of morals that are written in the Bible and that we've all that are, get passed down. And so they seem to be good things we're supposed to do. But then on the other hand, there's our self-interest. And so it's always your self-interest versus these morals.
Well, that's almost impossible to get rid of. I mean, it's so prevalent out there everywhere. Intellectuals hold those two as separate. The more people think about morality, the more they view them as separate. Self-interest and morality are two different areas of thinking.
Which is why in the clinical community, it's so hard to even begin the conversation, which is what I've been working on. Of considering how maybe thinking more and talking more about morality could be better rather than worse for our patients.
And then morality and self-interest might be the same thing or might be, you know, related. And therefore, we need to talk about them both. So I have to ask you about something because you mentioned it and I get harassed about this all the time. And that's this IQ stuff. So which it goes up and down, but recently because Sam Harris interviewed Charles Murray came back and there were a bunch of debates and I've often said, and you can tell me if I'm full of it or if you agree with me, but I've often said that I think IQ is only a partial measure of intelligence. Intelligence strikes me as a much broader concept than IQ. That I know a lot of people with very high IQ who are stupid, and I know a lot of people who are, you know, lower average IQ who are really smart in significant ways. And then and not even talk about morality, because I don't think IQ is correlated with moral behavior at all. But then second is, you know, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But
I have a hypothesis.
You have a hypothesis. That'd be interesting. And then the second is to what extent is it actually an issue of genes? Heredity. And then there's the whole issue of race, which I think is irrelevant because there is, I mean, I still think there is no such thing, not in a meaningful sense, because we're all mutts. And I think the genetic theory all shows that we're all mutts. So, you know, you can talk about where you come from, but calling somebody black or white or whatever is somewhat arbitrary. I just read somewhere that in Brazil, you're white if you have a little bit of white genes. Right, if one of your ancestors was white, you're considered white.
I'm white.
In America, if one of your ancestors was considered was black, you're considered black. So just it's a completely cultural orientation of how you know what you define. It has nothing to do with actual science. Okay, so let's go back to IQ. So what do you think about IQ?
Okay. So lots of things I can say. So first of all, I agree with you, and the science agrees with you, that there's a lot more to the broader concept of intelligence as it's used, I think, by in the lay lingo than mere IQ per se. So IQ correlates with but is never fully a determinant of actual performance at, you know, at work or on academic tests.
But somebody like Jordan Peterson continuously says it's the best predictor, it's a great predictor.
It is a great predictor because our predictors are all crappy.
What's that?
So because out of a bunch of crappy predictors,
okay.
It'll predict, you know, but when we say something like the best predictor in psychology, we mean, and I'm going to try to make this sort of intuitive. So statistically speaking, if something explains 10% of variance,
that's a lot.
That's like mind blowing.
Okay.
Because we're just bad at predicting stuff.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
But I mean, when you actually put in intelligence as a control, right, as a covariate, and then also put in, for example, what I was describing for rational thinking style, which is correlated with but distinct from IQ.
Yeah. Okay.
And probably less heritable than IQ, which is only 50% heritable, which is true of most personality traits, and doesn't mean you can't change it. You absolutely can, and that has now been shown and will continue to be shown. But in any case, even if we just take IQ as this fixed thing, which it's not, controlling for your IQ add something like rational thinking into the mix, add self-control into the mix.
Okay.
So like whether as a kid you were able to wait for the second marshmallow for 15 minutes, people are familiar with that study, it explains further variance above and beyond IQ. Lots of these things do. And again, we can't think of IQ as this, you know, even though this is assuming it's a static quantity that you're just born with, but it's just absolutely not. And behavior geneticists are the first ones to point that out. Again, that even how heritable it is varies with your environment and varies with your education, you know, attainment and so on and so on. So there are multiple ways in which psychologists are increasingly aware, though there are camps, you know, within psychology, but by and large, I would say there's a lot of sensitivity to the fact that IQ is not everything. And that the, even the construct itself, you know, needs further refinement and clarification because it consists of components like fluid versus crystallized intelligence and, you know, working memory versus verbal recall. Like, there are parts to it that are dissociable, even though they correlate.
So you looked like you wanted to say something about the relationship between intelligence and morality.
Okay. Well, so thank you for doubling back. So one hypothesis that I have been developing, and it's an intuition I had for a while, and now I'm trying to actually conceptualize it and test it, is this idea that intelligence, like any tool at our disposal, like any resource, can work for us or against us, depending on our moral motivations. So, you know, moral in the sense that now we might mean it in a more objectivist context. So to the extent that what you're trying to do is actually figure out what's right and figure out what's true, the smarter you are, all else being equal, you know, the more resources you have at your disposal to help you with that, the more easily you'll be able to kind of relate a bunch of different, you know, experiences and information that you've encountered and make something of it, you know, and integrate it together, the more, the better you'll be able to remember and draw upon your knowledge, right? Great. It'll serve you. But take the same amount of intelligence and add now a more kind of dishonest or evasive core, you know, motivation, to the extent that you're trying to get away with faking something, to the extent that you're trying to not look at a painful aspect of, you know, reality, the smarter you are, the better you are at doing that, right? So the better your excuses will be, the more of an elaborate story you can come up with to rationalize your behavior. And just as a double whammy on top of that, the harder it'll be for you to keep up the lie because you're smart, so you can see all the contradictions more easily. And, you know, I think I've encountered this a lot. Like, I've had a lot of sort of observational data to draw upon, but I've yet to really test it more formally in the lab.
So do you think smart liars, smart people who are dishonest suffer more from that dishonesty?
Yes.
So so somebody like Bernie Madoff, who is clearly smart, when he says he's happier in jail now than he was before. I mean, I believe him, but it's like, so somebody who's not as smart as Bernie Madoff, who just steals, feels bad, but it's just nowhere near as intense.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think they could have gotten as far or built up as large, you know, a web of deception if they weren't as smart as he was.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And therefore corrupted their own psychology and their own ability to think and their own ability to survive more. So that makes a lot of sense.
It's sort of like in, you know, thinking about the novels that we kind of share as a context for those who read, say, Atlas, without giving too much away.
Yeah.
It's like the damage that a Hugh Axton can do, you know, or what am I saying? Oh my God, not Hugh Axton. You know what I mean? Robert Stadler versus the good that a Hugh Axton can do.
Yes.
But the damage a Robert Stadler can do is far greater.
Even to himself is the point. Not just to the world, but even to himself.
Yes, exactly. Yep. And that's what I think is controversial in what I'm saying. You know, I think people generally will agree, oh yeah, sure, evil geniuses, you know, they do a lot more harm.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that, they do more harm to themselves fundamentally.
Yeah. Okay, we got two questions. I'm taking questions in the super chat where you put your dollars where your questions are. So these are people contributing money. So, and send me, thanks for the question. Okay, so here it is. Is an objective, philosophical, knowledgeable therapist better positioned to morally evaluate their patient than most, if not all, non-professionals in the patient's life? Oh. So is an objective, philosophical, knowledgeable therapist.
So someone who is familiar with objectivism.
Is, well, but a therapist. So I think he's differentiating between therapist and non-therapist. They're all objectivists.
Oh.
Is a therapist going to be in a better position to morally evaluate somebody than non-professional, I assume, objectivists in the patient's life?
Interesting. Well, I don't think I can make a blanket statement about that, because being a therapist, you know, certainly doesn't make us omniscient and doesn't mean that we have some sort of infallible access, you know, to people's psychologies. And it'll depend on what kind of therapist you are and, you know, how thoroughly trained and how kind of careful and rigorous in your judgment. But I would say it could give you an edge in terms of tuning you into certain kind of subtle, you know, interactions between certain motivations and certain emotional vulnerabilities, and kind of help you to ask the right questions, and also just help you to draw out more information from a person in terms of being able to ask questions in a non-threatening way, you know, and being able to kind of meet the person where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
So I would hope that it gives you an edge, but it's, you know, I would never issue a blanket guarantee that, yeah, don't worry, if you go to me, I will do a better job of giving you your moral diagnosis. You know?
Yeah, than a friend who's known you for a long time or who knows philosophically the same. It strikes me the psychologist would have some tools that maybe a non-professional wouldn't have, but it's not clear that you have the same context of knowledge. So
yeah, I would hope also we would, for myself, at least speaking for myself as a therapist, I would also hope, because of my therapeutic training, I would also have more of the sort of appropriate humility about what I don't know, so that I wouldn't necessarily be as quick to give you a moral diagnosis. Because
yes.
I think that's like an extremely difficult thing to assess.
People tend to jump to that. All right, one other question. I think we've answered this question, and I know your answer, but Action Jackson asks, do humans have free will?
I believe so.
Pretty straightforward. And how do we know? Well, a lot of people listening are confused, I think, and justifiably confused, because as you said, it's a hot topic. It's not an easy topic. By kind of the Sam Harris perspective, where he constantly talks about choices. He constantly talks about morality, and then he denies that there is such a thing as, in a sense, you, that there is a free, that there is free will.
So it's a really big question with lots of parts to it. So depending on what aspect is interesting and or confusing, you know, we could talk about that. But you know, when I say that I believe in free will, I think I mean something very specific and very different from most proponents of.
So tell us what you mean specifically when you say we have free will.
Yeah. So, you know, I drawing heavily on an objectivist framework, I regard free will as, first of all, being both a matter, both a legitimate set of choices that we actually have open to us, in the sense that we are our own causal agents, which is a really controversial view to hold, even among people in the mainstream intellectual community who say they believe in free will.
Yep.
When I was referring to like soft versus hard determinism, compatibilism, and compatibilism before. So I'm an incompatibilist on that framework. I guess I would have to be a libertarian if we respect those categories, in the sense that I actually think, you know, that the way causality works in the context of our own mental self-regulation is different from the way like physical causation works, right? Where you have sort of one cause for one effect, where ball hits another
ball.
The
billiard ball type thing,
And that the particular way in which, you know, that the primary choice we have that then determines that then opens up further choices for us that are more specific, that primary choice is the choice to engage our active mental processes or not. So the choice to, Ayn Rand calls it the choice to focus. I think there are lots of other ways psychologically of characterizing it, but it's, we have a capacity for example, either directing or not directing our attention, right? For kind of consciously, actively choosing both internally and externally what it is we're going to pay attention to, what we're going to think about, how hard we're going to think about it, what other questions we're going to ask ourselves. And I think that's really the locus of our capacity for making choices about what to do and how to live and, you know, what career to pursue, which I do think are meaningful choices. Mm-hmm. But I think we're only really choosing in a meaningful sense between those things to the extent that we're actively engaging our mind.
So the fundamental choice is that to engage one's mind, to focus.
And it's not a choice, you know, and this is where we get into debates even amongst the kind of objectivist scholarly community, but I don't think that that's a choice that is ever present in every waking moment, which I think is subject to debate.
Yep.
But I think it's a choice that frequently presents itself to us. There are ways to make it present itself more frequently than, you know, by practicing certain skills where we become aware of the option to direct our awareness more often. So it's complicated, but I think it's real.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that's the answer, Nan, to some of these MRI scans that Sam Harris reports on. You raise your hand, but the MRI shows that the brain decided to raise your hand before you knew you decided to raise your hand. But that's not what free will is about, right? It's the precondition for all of that.
Yeah, those famous experiments like the Libet, and that's one common, you know, source of evidence that people cite against free will. There's lots to be said, including that that's not what free will is in any important sense. But also, if you think about just the whole experimental design and the nature of the choices you're being asked to make, they're deliberately as meaningless as a choice can be, where there's no particular reason to raise your hand or not. So you just kind of randomly pick based on the weather, you know, just kind of based on how you're feeling, which of course means that you're...
That's not that cognitive, that part that we associate with free will in the brain is not what's being activated. Something else is.
Right.
All right. All right. So here's, I was going to go to this topic anyway. So here's another question we got. Does the tabula rasa position, blank slate position, contradict the evolutionary psychologist, parentheses, Peterson, idea of inherited, quote, stories about what life's about?
The short answer is, yeah, I think it does, but there's a lot more that could be said, as always.
So tell us more about what, given that you've talked about the fact that we do inherit certain things, right, that we have inclinations. I mean, I had two sons. From the very second they were born, they were different in temperament. You could tell immediately that they just had a different certain inclinations. Now, I don't know how much to read into that or not, but there was no doubt about it, right? Very similar genes, obviously, and yet, but very different. So, given that, what do we actually mean by tabula rasa?
Good question.
What did Ayn Rand mean, and is that the same thing? And then how is that different from the whole evolutionary psychology? But let's do question one first and then get to the evolutionary psychology.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. So what do we mean by tabula rasa, or in what sense would I endorse a view that we are tabula rasa, I guess? And then how is that similar or different from Rand? So as always, you know, I don't want to claim to speak perfectly for Rand. I know there's really good quotes out there that we could probably look up in the lexicon that would give us her precise formulation of this. I think mine is probably similar, but I don't want to claim that it's identical, right? So, but the best I can say briefly is that I think we are tabula rasa in terms of content, you know, so in terms of actual, you know, views, beliefs about the world, having actual concept, right? I don't think we are born with like a concept of a chair, a concept of love, you know, or anything in between. For justice, right? And I don't think that we're born certainly with any like moral, you know, I don't think we're born with pre-existing habits, even, you know, have kind of morally relevant habits of like thinking or not, or of being honest or not. So I certainly don't think, you know, that we are determined in any meaningful sense to believe any particular set of things or to be motivated in any particular direction. What I don't think is right to say is that we're tabula rasa with respect to resources, you know, kind of psychological, intellectual, and emotional mechanism. You know, I think the apparatus is it kind of comes prepackaged with all kinds of things.
Give me an idea of what a resource, IQ is obviously, or intelligence or some form of that is a resource, but what would be a psychological and emotional resource?
Yeah, so again, this is all still somewhat speculative. Sure. I know there are personality psychologists working on these questions that I don't want to claim to know definitively, but reasonable guesses include, for example, a temperamental predisposition to be kind of, I mean, the way that you as a parent would experience it, right? Like being more of a colicky, more of a reactive, hard to soothe baby, let's say, versus more of an easygoing, easy to soothe, less sort of emotionally reactive baby, right? But that seems to be a difference that's online from very early on. It's hard to account for it through any sort of conceptual, you know, processing or learning that would have happened in the 2 seconds, you know, after leaving the womb, right? And clearly there are these distinct temperamental differences. So that would be kind of one category, of emotional reactivity. Relatedly, but distinctly, I'd say what's referred to as behavioral inhibition, though I'm not claiming that that's necessarily a good term, but what it describes is, again, kind of this tendency to be more cautious versus more risk-taking.
Yep.
Somehow, whatever the inputs, right? What you consider to be safe versus dangerous, I don't think that's given to you at birth. I think you have to figure it out, right? But if you, you know, to the extent that you've been somehow, you know, you've decided something is yay dangerous or yay safe, what sort of how much anxious feeling will you get if you start to approach it? And sort of how much relief will you feel if you move away from it? And then simultaneously on the kind of behavioral activation front, as it's referred to in the literature, how much kind of positive surge of emotion do you feel given a certain amount of, given so much value offered or gained? You know, if you kind of hold constant how much value something has for you, like the milk bottle, you know, if you're a baby, or your husband or wife telling you they love you, you know, as an adult, kind of all else being equal, given everything you believe, given everything that it means to you, just like how much kind of activation of pleasurable feeling will you feel? Something along those lines.
Okay. And so what about, I know a lot of people and evolutionary psychologists certainly who think things like emotions like envy, are hardwired somehow, or a result of some of these hardwired things, that some of us tend to be more envious, some of us tend to be less envious, and maybe this is why they say some people are socialists, some people are not, because you know, envy drives these things. Is envy something that you think could be hardwired in any kind of sense, or could you see a link between the things that are hardwired to an emotion like envy?
No. So yeah, good. That's a great example to work with. So I think what the evolutionary psychology perspective does that makes it hard to think about the hypotheses is that there's a packaging together. It's sort of like, you know, how I just distinguish between these two things. There's the content, and then there's sort of the hardware. There's the software and the hardware.
Yeah.
You could look at it that way, right? So there's this, like, the hardware that we come equipped with, which is like a bunch of wires that are ready to connect to whatever we, you know, kind of plug them into. But some of the wires are just like, they're more electrically charged than others, or, you know, they're like file folders that are bigger or smaller, but the folder is empty of content till we fill it with something, right? It, as an evolutionary psychologist, you don't make that distinction. Everything is hardware, in effect.
Yep.
That's the way of thinking about it. So envy is just a bunch of hardware that causes us to feel this way and to behave in these ways, but there's no accounting for the content, the beliefs that you form about yourself and about other people and about standards of value by which you should be evaluating yourself and other people, you know, and about the good and about, you know, how you ought to operate your mind, right? All of which is going to impact whether you feel envy and then whether you act on it separately. And then, you know, the fact that there's a certain chosen response that you could have to feeling envy that I think deliberation can really intervene
yeah.
between you feeling like, oh, like I want to tear this person down so I don't have to see them and feel inferior, and actually doing something to tear them down. So you don't, right? I mean, I think there's a huge world of choice there that then determines your tendency to feel envy in the future. So
yeah.
No, I don't think it's
okay.
Hard.
And so what do cognitive psychologists, not objectivists, but just the cognitive psychology field, think about evolutionary psychology? Because it seems like what they're doing, the evolutionary psychologists would say you can't do, in a sense, which is rewire the hardwire.
Interesting. So I have a couple of thoughts on that. I don't actually think most evolutionary psychologists, except like maybe the most corrupt ones,
yeah.
like I don't think most psychologists with that framework would say you can't change
okay.
the hardwiring. I just
okay.
think the way they think about the changes is going to be a little bit different. Right? But sure, you can, you know, you can fix a computer that's broken.
Yep.
Like you can
yep.
plug in a new hard drive.
Yep.
Or,
yep.
And that's the limit
the
of my
wiring. Yeah. Yep.
Whereas, yeah, but what they would tend to underemphasize is the role of the actual content, right? And the role of the thinking that one does. It, as a cognitive behavioral therapist, I think we talked about this a little bit yesterday, is that we do draw upon certain hypotheses from evolutionary psychology. And I think to some extent, it's valid to do so because some of them make a lot of sense and actually have a lot of explanatory value for patients, for example, who are dealing with panic attacks that just happen out of the blue. And a person often will come in feeling like they're just crazy and there's something deeply wrong with them, that they keep having these panic attacks. Like, what is my problem? I must be weak. I must be so irrational. And then we explain, okay, look, so as humans, you know, as animals, really, we have this fight or flight system that seems to have been, you know, kind of built in by evolution to warn us against impending, you know, dangers. And it's great it's there, because if it weren't, we wouldn't have survived this far. You know, we would have just gotten eaten by a tiger because we wouldn't have thought to run away, you know. And so it's great that it's there, but sometimes it gets miswired and then we get these false alarms.
Okay.
And, you know, so kind of just being able to put it into perspective that it's not that you're crazy. Like, this is a natural part of you
yep.
that's just gone a little haywire, and we can fix it. And the fix has to do with the fact that it's partly conceptual and also partly hardwired. You know, that there's sort of a mix of things that we're fixing the hardware partly through the software, because
yeah.
that's what we
yeah.
can most directly access.
And part of the hardware, so I was going to ask you this, part of the hardware seems to be chemical, right? So it's not hardware. It's, and chemicals
yeah.
could get out of balance. So to what extent do you think that chemical imbalances affect our psychology? And therefore, to what extent do you think then medication, which tries to fix the chemical imbalances,
mm-hmm.
and it, just to add complexity, to what extent generally is you know, the secretion of chemicals in our brain a consequence of hardwiring or software?
Oh, well, so this is where I really have to express, I have to disclaim
yeah.
whatever speculations I'm going to make,
sure.
especially given the current state of the field, because there's raging debate that's been ongoing and doesn't seem to be anywhere close to resolving. We're concerning this very issue, you know, concerning to what degree are chemical imbalances really causally at play in particular disorders and in differences between people generally, and then to what extent do the medications actually make a difference, and for whom, and in what circumstances, and to what extent do we overprescribe? And there's so much, pick a view and you'll find at least, you know, 20 professional scholarly psychologists out there who have that view, or psychiatrists,
sure. Sure.
Researchers in the field who have that view, and they all cite evidence in favor of their view. And so it's really hard to make any sense of it right now, other than just to say it's an empirical question and they make some sort of difference for sure,
sure,
but we can't really say how much, and we just don't know enough to, you know, to provide like a detailed account of how and to what degree the various neurotransmitters in our brain are causing what dysfunction. But we can say that they're relevant and that they're not all that's happening. You know.
Well, the very fact that you can take LSD and go on a trip suggests that chemicals have an impact on how our brain is functioning. So,
of course. Yeah. I mean, we definitely know at a basic level you know, we would be dead if the neurotransmitters in our brain just got sucked out or just stopped.
But we don't understand why, for example, you know, the chemical imbalance gets off.
We don't quite understand. We have hypotheses. Sure. There are lots of hunches. You know, there's a dopamine hypothesis of schizophrenia, although dopamine turns out to also be involved in ADHD and depression and anxiety, you know, just you name it, but in sort of slightly different ways, and we're not quite sure. With depression, so I know the most about the current status of the empirical literature in depression, so on antidepressant medications.
Yeah.
And what I can tell you is so far, it looks like antidepressants, so what are called SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, one type of mechanism that allows for more serotonin to be released into parts of the brain that we think might, you know, help with depression, that they seem to actually help the people who are the most severely depressed. If you do a really kind of conservative, rigorous review of the literature, and not just consider, you know, is this a randomized clinical trial with a placebo control condition, et cetera, but consider like the researchers' biases in terms of how they even recruited participants and whether the pharma, you know, whether there was a kind of big pharma interest, where this is almost like a paranoid level of control of scientific controls. And still what you do find is, yeah, there's no question if you're severely depressed, like at the top of the range, not getting out of bed, antidepressants seem to help.
Yep.
With everyone else, like it's a little bit more mixed, but they do definitely seem to help at least some people. And I can say this definitively as a therapist, because once my patients start taking antidepressants, for a lot of them, though not all, that's when therapy can really get started.
Oh, okay.
Because they get activated.
Because gets activated. So here's a question. I don't know if you can, I mean, my guess is you'll hedge again, which is good. No, it's not hedging. It's putting the right context. To what extent do you think we will discover that moral values affect something like dopamine levels in our brain, right?
Oh, I don't have to hedge that.
Okay.
That's a question.
Okay.
Actually.
So our values, our own, the way we think, the choices we make are going. So this is a feedback. It goes in both directions, in other words.
Oh, yeah. See, I don't have to hedge on
right.
this one.
Great.
I mean, unless you ask me, like, what is the exact amount of dopamine that gets released at over what time interval, you know, but does our thinking and our choices and do our values and beliefs over time affect the chemical, the function of our brain and the neural pathways, you know, functional and structural connectivity of different brain? Yeah, we know that now. Absolutely. I mean, CBT research has shown that, you know, and research on mindfulness-based interventions and how they change the brain, you know, and all you're doing is you're practicing paying attention on purpose in the present moment.
That's cool.
That's it. Yeah. So, yeah. Definitely.
Okay. So I've got two more questions and then I think I'll let you go. So although people are saying they could listen to you all day, that this is fascinating. Yeah. You're getting great compliments here on the chat. So actually three questions because somebody just posted a question as well. Self-esteem. So self-esteem has always been kind of at the bedrock of objectivist's approach to psychology. Ayn Rand talked about it. Nathaniel Brandon talked about it, did a lot of stuff with it. What are your thoughts about its importance and how it plays a role in this idea of cognitive psychology or just generally in psychology?
Well, this is great because with questions like that, I will talk all day. So it's okay.
Go for it.
Okay, let's see. What can I briefly say and then leave room for follow-up? I taught a course on self-esteem several years ago. Not that I stand by everything I said, but I'm happy to, you know.
So it's on. It's in the bookstore?
It may or may not. I don't remember if it ever made it into the bookstore.
Okay.
But, hey, maybe.
Check it out. Yeah, maybe we can.
Maybe
we can
now.
Encourage people.
There's incentive. But, no, I'm also just happy to share notes from it and share my thinking sentence with anyone who's interested in more detail. Okay, so briefly, what can I say? The question is just, what about self-esteem?
Yeah, just open like that. It deserve that central role as really the bridging concept in objectivism, at least between philosophy and psychology? At least it seems that way from Rand and Brandon's writing. Does it deserve that role? And you know, is there anything I'd say new beyond what they wrote about it?
Yeah, so let's see. So I would say, yes, it deserves the central role that it plays in, you know, Rand's and kind of early Brandon's conceptions of psychological health and, you know, of life as a human. Psychologists, I think, generally would agree, although they, some of them may use different terms or you know, may have slightly different conceptions of it. I would say in terms of the kinds of things that have been learned from empirical psychology, from the a mainstream scholarship on psychology beyond what like Brandon wrote, I would say there's a lot we can learn in terms of kind of filling in a lot of the particulars and actually drawing guidance from specific therapeutic practices for kind of changing and improving our self-esteem over time, or even just, you know, maintaining it if it's already good. I would say, I wouldn't say that there's anything that's happened in psychology that contradicts or casts, you know, doubt on the basic core conception of self-esteem that Rand proposed, that, you know, it's this automatized conviction that you're both capable and worthy of living, right? I think that actually maps on really well to a lot of the kind of automatic thoughts and core beliefs that cognitive behavioral psychologists talk about. And it covers both a lot of the self-efficacy research, of which there's tons. That was a tradition that Bandura was famous for, but lots and lots of psychologists have acknowledged, you know, the kind of ubiquitous importance of it. And so self-efficacy being really more on the, like, you're capable side. The kinds of things we've learned about that include everything from kind of perceived versus actual capability, as well as domain-specific capability, that the fact that it seems that just empirically speaking, it's almost more useful to measure your self-efficacy in specific domains, whereas it seems harder to capture your kind of universal core self-efficacy, although I do think that that's a, you know, that's a real psychological phenomenon, that that we have a certain core estimate at any given point in time of our competence and our overall kind of ability to figure things out and to thrive. But it's closely tied to our more domain specific beliefs. And it's also, you know, when I say perceived versus actual, there's very important intervening sort of premises that have to do with, for example, the malleability of your ability. So if you're familiar with the growth mindset research and literature, Carol Dweck, some people say it's ubiquitous, some people haven't heard of it yet. So I'll throw it out there because I think it's really valuable and insightful kind of literature. So the idea of this growth mindset versus a more fixed mindset that you could have with respect to your intelligence, with respect to your ability, your skill, it turns out to have massive implications for everything from how quickly you give up on a difficult task, how defensive you get in response to feedback, sort of how much you challenge yourself, the kinds of goals that you even take on. So a lot of the same things that we know are tied to self-esteem, right? And all that it means to have a growth mindset is that you believe that your traits are changeable by your effort or not. So if you believe that you just sort of have this innate, essential level of ability that isn't up to you, you're going to be constantly trying to just prove to yourself that you have it because there's nothing you can do to actually develop it or change it. And you're going to be, therefore, a lot more threatened by mistakes, by failures, and it's going to somehow, you know, mean a lot more to you and be much more metaphysical, to use some of kind of that lingo, every time that you know, you realize you've made a mistake or you realize you have done something bad, you know. And I think this applies to morality too. You know, if you realize, oh, I've been evading, I've been doing that thing that Rand calls evasion, and that makes me just like morally irredeemable. You know, if you think of it that way, rather than thinking, oh, so
I need to stop.
I feel bad, but I can actually improve this. What do I do differently? How do I go about, you know, being more in focus more of the time? Like, you know, what resources do I seek out to help me with that? That makes a huge difference in even just the development of self-esteem over time and the maintenance of it, kind of what it even means to you, you know, how you're even assessing yourself. So that's a huge one. And then there's lots of other things like that that turn out to make a big difference, but that aren't elaborated as part of kind of the original conception of self-esteem that we get from Rand and Brandon. There's more I could say, but that's probably a good time to say.
Good. So There's tons more I could ask, but we're at an hour 20 already. Let me take, we've got one question on here, which I think is also interesting. Should one go to see a psychologist only if they have a problem? Or is it recommended to go in and talk with one without any sort of goal in mind? Well, that's kind of, that's a false, you know.
That's interesting. I was about, yeah, I was too quick.
Yeah. No, okay. Answer the first one and then take into account what he says the second part.
Yeah. Let's see. So, no. So, I strongly believe that we should be moving in a direction where psychotherapy and your mental health treatment, as we currently conceive of it, like, should not be a remediation only kind of trade, you know, that it shouldn't be something we only seek out when there are problems, but rather it should just be like a core part of our curriculum growing up. And it should be, I think it's one of the most basic skill sets, you know, next only preceded by rational thinking, which we just clearly need for everything. Sure. Right. Yeah. But short of that, like, I think having sort of psychological competence and having knowledge and awareness and skill connected to your own emotional well-being, and if that's even a concept, whatever, but, you know, kind of your own psychological hygiene, I think everybody can benefit from it. I think everyone needs it. And no, I don't think it should be remediation only. Whereas the second question was, you know, should you just kind of go without a goal in mind? Well, that sort of depends on, like, the current kind of sociological layout of the field. But right now, in our current context, I mean, I don't see anything wrong with doing that, but it might not, well, A, it might be practically very difficult unless you're very rich, because we tend to cost a lot, and insurance companies, if they're going to cover any of your, you know, whatever it is, $150 to $250 to $350 an hour at all, it'll be some portion, and it'll only be with a diagnosis in place. So the current model is, you know, you have to be sick in order to get this treatment, which I'm saying is the wrong model, but it's what we have right now. And so, just practically speaking, that's difficult. Also, and I should say this regarding both parts of the question, it really depends who you go to. And I wish I could say our field was at a point where you could just trust that you know, look up, like, your local therapist and you kind of just go to see one and then they'll be good and they'll help you more than hurt you. But unfortunately, we're not in a place where I can say that with confidence. And so it's a lot of work. Like, there's a lot of sort of startup costs, unfortunately, to going and actually seeing someone good who can really do some good for you and with you.
And even if you're looking for a cognitive psychologist, there's a wide variety of quality.
Yes. Okay. And there's now at this point in time, almost everyone who does therapy and has, like, a Psychology Today profile lists cognitive behavioral therapy in their set of, you know, specializations, and almost nobody does it. So do the math. Yeah. So it's actually really hard. It's easy. So one of the pro bono services I've been providing extensively to friends, family, friends of friends, and I remain open to requests, and I'll do my best to get back to you as needed. I find referrals for people in their local community or their geographical area, because I have access to some listservs and some contact, you know, so when you have connections, it's a little bit easier, but it's really, a lot of it ends up being word of mouth or knowing which kind of listservs to check. It's hard.
Yep.
And I wish I could say that it was easy, but it's really hard. And I'm more than happy to advise anyone who is curious, you know, to look in their area. There's now also increasingly a teletherapy option that some therapists are offering. I'm working on making it such that I can provide teletherapy across state lines, but it's still kind of a jungle out there in terms of the regulations and making sure I don't get, you know, my license stripped away so soon after having earned it. But I know that in every state, there will be some therapists who are willing to do teletherapy. And some therapists are now increasingly able to provide more flexible, you know, teletherapy. So wherever you meet on, like Zoom or Skype.
Yeah, somebody writes here, I have had more help from understanding objectivism than from any several therapists I've been to. And that goes back to where we started, kind of the relationship between moral values and psychological health. I mean, they're very much related.
Yeah, me too.
So, yeah.
If I'm honest about it, I mean, if I were to calculate the variance explained, you know, in much to use statistical language, sure, in my current level of happiness and health and success, how much of it I attribute to Rand and all that followed from reading Rand versus to the couple therapists that I've seen in, you know, historically, yeah, and yeah, one of them was extremely helpful, but like, I mean, comparatively speaking.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Good. Well, thank you, Gina. Is there some way that you want people to reach out to you, right? Social media, website, stuff like that?
Sure. I'm working on the website.
Okay.
For now, I'm happy to have people email me at gina.gorlin@gmail.com. So it's gena.gorlin@gmail.com. You can also find me on Facebook under the same name.
Great.
Probably we'll have mutual friends at this point with anyone on this call, I'm guessing.
Well, maybe, maybe not. I mean, it's a pretty broad call. We'll have a few thousand people listening or watching this. So,
cool. Yeah, but feel free to email me, yeah, if nothing else, and that way.
Good.
We'll
and we're going to have to have you back because I've still got a list of questions that we haven't talked about. So we will have you back to cover those. Thanks. This was great.
Thank you. This was really fun.
Great. Yeah. Have a great rest of the weekend. Bye, everybody. Off. Let's see. Episode.